Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today we're going to talk about Bill 108. I pause for the booing that's coming from municipal staff at Ontario's 444 cities, towns, and villages because Bill 108, called the More Homes, More Choices Act, is going to have immediate, major, and far-reaching implications for how municipalities plan and pay for development. The Ontario government seems pleased with what they've passed, and Ontario developers are likely going to be pleased with less red tape and regulation, but municipal staff, environmental activists, and other advocacy groups are not so pleased with the implications of Bill 108, many of which are still unknown. So, Bill 108 is the topic of this edition of the Guelph Politicast. Now, Bill 108 was passed before the Ontario legislature rose for the summer, so its effects are now baked in the cake, as they say. It's an omnibus bill that changed 13 different pieces of legislation, and they are the Cannabis Control Act, the Development Charges Act, the Education Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Environmental Assessment Act, the Environmental Protection Act, Local Planning Appeal Tribunal Act, the Labor Relations Act, the Occupational Health and Safety Act, the Ontario Heritage Act, the Ontario Water Resources Act, the Planning Act, and the Workplace Safety and Insurance Act. Not exactly archaic legislation that's outdated and will have no effect on most of the people in Ontario. Although Ontario citizens are no strangers to quick sweeping change at this point, 1 year into the Doug Ford era, the whiplash effect from 108 is especially jarring. In the city of Guelph's case, the changes to development charges could blow a $100 million hole in the city's capital forecast on a wide variety of community improvement projects, like new parks and facilities such as rec centers and libraries. The city of Guelph passed a motion at the end of May that formally opposed Bill 108, and it also called on the government of Ontario to enable fulsome consultation with municipalities, which of course did not happen because just over a week later, the Ontario legislature retired for 144 days, and they offered just 1 day of debate before the third and final reading of Bill 108. And that's just the development of facts of the act, which says nothing about the potential new sprawl that Bill 108 allows for, or things like the quote-unquote pay-to-slay provision, which allows developers to pay a fee to pave over what was once protected habitat. That in particular prompted all three opposition parties to unite in a press conference decrying the bill. Guelph MPP Mike Schreiner said, quote, "It's time to put partisanship aside and put the public interest first, and I'm proud to stand with other parties, municipal leaders, citizen groups, and responsible developers who are saying that we can build homes for people without destroying homes for wildlife." That was on Tuesday, and the legislature rose 2 days later. So on this edition of the Guelph Politicast, we'll hear from three different people about the immediate and long-term effects that Bill 108 might have. First, we'll hear from David Amborski, a professor at the School of Urban and Regional Planning at Ryerson University, who will give us some background on municipal planning and talk about the broader effects of Bill 108 on cities. And then Emily Giles, the Senior Specialist for Species Conservation for the WWF Canada, will lay out how Bill 108 will affect environmental policy, especially the protection of endangered species in Ontario. And then finally, Tara Baker, the General Manager of Finance and the Treasurer for the City of Guelph, will talk about how the Royal City will specifically be impacted by Bill 108 and what that means for future major capital projects like the South End Community Centre and the new main branch of the library. So let's get started being better informed about Bill 108. So David, could you first maybe lay out a bit of background in terms of development charges? You know, how did they come about? Why are they the tool used for, improving infrastructure and things in cities? You know, how did cities come to depend on the DCs?
Well, development charges have a very long history in Ontario, probably longer than any place in North America. Mm. They go back to requirements under the Planning Act, where subdivision agreements could be entered into and other conditions could be imposed, some of which could be financial. And the first step, of course, was to have developers pay for all services internal to subdivision by providing them in kind. Mm. Then it became clear that there were off-site capital costs as well, and they began to put charges in place for the off-site capital costs of growth-related services. And this began by looking at the hard services, and later it was expanded to the soft services. So during the early years, the 60s, the 70s, and the early 80s, there's a lot of controversy about how the charges should be calculated, what should be included, when the payments should be made, and so on. So for a period of time, there was a number of committees looking at what to do in terms of creating legislation. Most of these committees were joint committees with the industry and municipalities or with AMO. They ended up kind of not going anywhere with a number of governments. Then finally, in 1989, the then provincial government brought in the first development charge legislation under the Development Charges Act and tried to clarify the rules under which development charges could be imposed. It included, at that point, all growth-related capital costs, both hard and soft, and they developed a methodology for doing the calculation. The surprise that came in both the green paper and ultimately legislation, and people didn't expect, they also put in place the opportunity for education development charges to help fund the cost of schools.
Right. So just for people listening to understand the difference between hard and soft DCs, hard is basically the stuff that you can't build a street without, so the road, the sewers, things like that, and then the soft is
property-related services, basically, sewer, water, roads, curbs, street lighting, those kinds of things.
Right.
Soft services would refer to such things as libraries, theaters, parks, recreation facilities, and so on. And then there's kind of in between, both people and property-related services, things like new fire halls and things like police stations and policing capital costs. Those kind of actually support both property and people. So it's kind of one of those ones that kind of fall a little bit in between.
Right. And theoretically, although I gather developers probably aren't very fond of paying development charges, it eats into their profits. But, you know, there is kind of a give and take, because obviously if a city is collecting development charges to build, let's say, a rec center or a new park in an area, that adds value, that if you're continuing to build in this area of the city, it makes it more appealing that there's these kind of amenities nearby.
Well, many should be provided in some fashion anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, they have to be provided. I mean, developers really became accustomed to for making payments of development charges. What I think the objection comes is that they increased dramatically, they're expanded to cover a broader range of services than they originally intended to cover. You know, developers always say, give us the rules and then we can, you know, adjust our financials accordingly. And the reality is that if, in fact, developers know they're going to face a certain development charge, a certain magnitude, they can build that into pro forma, and part of that can be capitalized into pre-development land values. The problem comes when the rules keep changing and municipalities increase them dramatically, either because they change the way they're calculated or they include new things under the charge, and they were anticipated.
Right. So, I mean, from what you're describing, though, maybe from the developer's point of view, maybe this isn't something that works entirely to their favor, the changes made in Bill 108, because now there's this sudden change to how the DCs are collected and what they're collected for.
No, I think from what I gather, from what I've read from the building association groups, this bill is trying to put a little more certainty into it. They're trying to cap the education development charges, which is something they weren't that could explode in the past. And they're trying to provide, as they indicate in the Bill 108 documents, they're trying to provide more certainty involved. So if the rules are known, that always makes it easier for developers to understand what's going to happen. And I can give you a little example of the difference of that, too, because that's one of the issues, if we move to discussion of Section 37, is that developers never know what they're going to have to pay for the Section 37 contributions. That, if you kind of contrast it to what they do in Vancouver, there they have something called community amenity agreements, but there the developers have a better understanding of what they might pay, because the city of Vancouver tries to collect a certain percentage of the increase in value from a change in zoning, and they work from a common pro forma. So they know if they have to pay 30% or 40%, the developers can somewhat calculate that and build that into the financials. Here in Ontario, under Section 37, there is much to the political whim of local councillors and what they want to impose. So developers really didn't have a good idea of what they're going to have to do in terms of Section 37 contributions until they're well into the process. So again, that's kind of an illustration of where developers prefer to have some kind of certainty, and it causes less distortions in the market. Let's try to push forward those costs out to the purchaser or the renter,
right,
and less impact on developers' profits, which causes them to have problems and hiccups and maybe not build as much.
Right. Which, of course, some people might say is not a problem, not building as much.
Well, supply has been identified as an issue. That's the whole thing
right.
It's about. And supply of all kinds of housing. Rental is
right.
one issue, and purpose-built rental. And it certainly impacts on that, because usually purpose-built rental tries to get increased density. So that's one which Section 37 would affect directly.
Mm.
And the same would be true of supply of ground-associated units, single-family. And that's been identified as being an issue of supply by both CMHC and by the province. And the whole thrust of this Bill 108 is trying to find ways to increase supply so not have as much upward pressure on prices by creating better certainty, making more land available by pre-zoning, and by trying to expedite the approvals and building permit process.
Yeah, and I think, you know, here in Guelph, where there's an issue with, you know, we have statistically low vacancy, you look at the numbers, basically the statistics say Guelph is full. There's not much in the way of availability. But I think anecdotally, too, you drive around the city, you see subdivisions being built all the time. And I think people sort of feel like, you know, there's more at play than just whether or not developers have enough loose room to build that, and whether or not that's going to be resolved by the issues presented in 108.
I'm not sure I follow, because
right.
observing something being built isn't the same thing as evidence-based what the supply is and what the prices are.
I absolutely agree.
So I'm not sure what your question was there in that particular
well,
case.
Well, no, I just, you know, I'm wondering, I guess, does the bill sort of offer more of a free hand to developers to build how they wish? And in your learned opinion, will this actually lead to less, you know, more availability, more homes for people, better prices?
I don't think it's trying to actually give them more free hand.
Mm.
If you read the document as well, one of the things they say at the beginning of their provincial document, more homes, more choice, they talk about putting money into infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the issue in some areas, and I don't know the Guelph situation entirely,
mm-hmm.
is that there hasn't been investment in infrastructure from senior levels of government.
Right.
That's been part of the reason why we've seen development charges increasing, because there hasn't been the same kind of thrust. If you go way back and looking at the great expansion of housing in Peel Region, Mississauga, for example,
mm-hmm.
the infrastructure there was part of what's called the South Peel Servicing Scheme. Well, that was created by funding from CMHC. CMHC used to provide infrastructure funding.
Okay.
If you look at the surge in funding development in New York region in the 80s and early 90s in places like Markham, Richmond Hill, and Vaughan, that servicing put in place for that was something called the York-Durham Servicing Scheme that came up the east side of Metro Toronto across the top of Metro Toronto.
Mm.
So there is major infrastructure investments from provincial and federal governments to help provide that in place. One of the problems right now in New York region is that there's not funding available other than D.C. funding to try and expand some of the infrastructure to increase the supply of service lots. So one of the things they mention here is that they plan to put more infrastructure funding in place, which also could help that supply issue.
Right. And is that separate from D.C.'s, or is that part of the new model for how D.C.
I think it's part of the new model.
Okay.
You know, whether they follow through with it or not is open to question.
If
you go back to the growth plan, when that came into place, when the Liberals brought in that particular growth plan, they also created something called the Ministry of Infrastructure Renewal.
Mm.
And the whole idea of that was that there was going to be infrastructure made available to support the growth plan. But I don't think that funding ever flowed as it was expected.
Right. I've heard the expression, development doesn't pay for itself.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something, in terms of your research, do the DCs collected actually cover the infrastructure? Are we maybe having talking around a bigger conversation in terms of like how infrastructure is funded in cities in the province, that, you know, maybe the DCs aren't enough. Maybe we need to be looking at models beyond DCs.
Well, again, the models beyond DC is funding that comes from provincial and federal grants.
Right.
Again, we're not going to have as much federal grant money here in that particular case as we had in previous years, because there used to be flows back in a long time ago when CMHC had funding available.
Right.
And other activities. But, you know, there may be some provincial money that could be used. Now, of course, there's tight budgets everywhere. Mm-hmm. But traditionally, there was funding made available for these kinds of things. And, in fact, that was what most of the older areas were funded on, based on grants from other levels of government for infrastructure. So the funding model's changed, so you're looking at other avenues. But again, there's not a lot of options. And again, if you look at DCs, we have, you know, Ontario has the highest development charges, or if you call them in the U.S. impact fees in North America.
Mm.
That were kind of the, by far, some of the highest that exist anywhere. So the question is, you know, how high can they go before they continue to impact on house prices and affordability?
Right.
So it's a bit of a conundrum. You know, we've talked about using some alternatives, and our Center for Urban Research and Land Development did a study saying, what if, in fact, rather than having DCs for sewer and water, use full-cost pricing? In other words, the price you charge for sewer and water reflected both the capital costs and the operating costs. So it would be a different way of funding things, and it would be based on the usage,
right,
and it would be more equitable. It would knock $20,000 or $30,000 in some cases off DCs, and maybe make housing more affordable in the longer run.
Huh.
You know, so that's one of the alternatives that could be used, as well as perhaps getting some more funding from senior levels of government.
Hmm. Yeah, it seems to me, and I'm by no means a financial expert on any of this, but you know, there's just such limited options for cities in terms of funding, you know, on any level, whether that's infrastructure, whether that's operating expenses, capital, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about your thoughts about this concern. A lot of people are looking at Bill 108 as perhaps creating more sprawl, that, you know, we're going to be looking at less density, more sprawl, because, correct me if I'm wrong, but it basically allows for the places to grow established. Maybe it wasn't places to grow, but I know it's established that cities in Ontario have their borders and that they cannot grow beyond those borders. But does Bill 108 say that that's not the case anymore?
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
In fact, there's been very little change in the growth plan.
Okay.
From Bill 108. It hasn't been very, very significant.
Okay.
So, you know, And I always laugh a little bit when I hear sprawl, because sprawl is a very relative thing. You know, what we've had fairly responsible and fairly intensive development compared to most North American cities, compared to other places like Atlanta and other places. We've done pretty well in that. And you know, it's one of the things with the last growth plan, did encourage intensification, the first 10-year growth plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're pretty good in that context.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps some of the activists are overthinking, or, you know, maybe a bit concerned for not that this is going to lead in more sprawl.
I don't think that's going to be the case.
Okay. The other piece of this I think we're interested in is changes, basically the reversion of the LPAT back to the old OMB rules, and I know you've appeared before the LPAT, the OMB.
Not the LPAT, just the OMB.
Oh, okay. So you haven't had an opportunity to appear before the LPAT yet.
No.
It's a weird, you know, this is going to be a weird circumstance for them, because, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but we have appeals that are still before, what's extant under the OMB rules before they were changed to the LPAT rules. Now we have appeals being heard under the LPAT rules passed by the previous government, and so now we're going to have like sort of a third column of...
Yeah, I don't know how they're dealing with the transition. It's a bit
right.
of a mess. Part of the problem is that the Bill 108, the regulations haven't all been put in place yet, and the regulations might clarify how they're going to deal with that, as the same is true for some of the other pieces where there haven't been regulations put in place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think one of the reasons, you know, the the LPAT process created quite a backlog as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the reason for changing it was trying to expedite the approvals process because so many developments were tied up in backlog of LPAT and wasn't sure when they're going to come forward.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that might have been part of the thinking behind that.
Mm-hmm. Is it just possible that this is an imperfect process no matter what rules you use and there's always going to be a backlog?
Well, the OMB had a backlog, but they found ways to reduce that backlog over the years.
Mm.
If you look at the history of the OMB, sometimes the backlog was quite substantial. And then they found administrative ways of dealing with it. They changed the items that were covered by the OMB. They used to approve capital funding through bonds. They took that off the plate.
Mm.
They reduced the range of things that the OMB would deal with. They were no longer appeal committee of adjustment issues to the OMB. So they found ways of reducing the workload, and they tried to find ways of increasing efficiencies in the way the board operated. So I'm not saying it was perfect, but they did take some measures to try to address and deal with that over time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the reason for changing to the LPAT wasn't so much any backlog of the OMB. It was rather the previous government did not like the way the OMB operated in terms of their operating procedures and some of the outcomes that are coming out. They didn't like particularly de novo hearings.
Right.
Issue.
Well, having said that, has this all become maybe too political?
It's always been very political, absolutely. And again, people look at some of the high-profile cases and they think there's a decision that continues to happen on one side or the other, favoring one side, based on a high-profile decision. If you read some of the literature, Aaron Moore's book on the OMB and some of the other work, most of those kind of academic pieces seem to suggest that the board isn't overly biased one way or the other. They come down on both sides. And their rule was to look at what was good planning in the provincial interest. Even sometimes there were cases where people seemed to think that counselors would oppose something, even though the counselors thought it was good, because their local constituents opposed it, knowing that they'd be saved by the OMB, who would ultimately overturn it as good planning.
Right.
They could have the political benefit of siding with their constituents at the same time, knowing in the bigger picture good planning would prevail through the OMB process. So there's a lot of political shenanigans and games that get played into that for sure.
Oh, well, that's life, I think.
Maybe
to wrap up, in terms of your academic interests, this is your area of expertise. What are you going to be looking at in terms of how this is going to work out over the long term? What are you going to be focusing on?
Well, I mean, the big issue is how is this going to be implemented? What are the regulations going to say? What are the regulations going to say? One of the things they're trying to increase the density around transit stations.
Mm.
And in order to do that, the province is having the community permit system being required around those areas to try to have land appropriately pre-zoned to increase the supply available for higher density development around transit. Without that being in place, cities might sit there and say, okay, we'll keep our old zoning and require developers to all go through Section 37, which will take them 2 years to get land ready for approval.
Mm.
Here they're trying to get pre-zoning in place to increase supply, particularly in transit-oriented areas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't know how it's going to work with municipalities being willing to implement community planning permits. There's been resistance to that. And it's also the case that inclusionary zoning can only be put in place where we have a community planning permit system in place. So there's a lot of questions about that implementation. The same thing is true with the replacement for Section 37. I think something can be done in Section 37 because of the way it's tied into a political process here and not understandable or transparent. So now we're moving into community benefits, but the regulations aren't written yet, so it's not clear how that's going to unfold. So the rules and implementation of those policies can be something that's very important that will determine the success or failure of how they operate.
Is this the usual way this is done when you have like rather big planning changes like this where we pass a bill and then we're going to work out how we're going to implement that after the fact?
Yeah, usually the regulations follow. Depends how quickly they follow. Sometimes some of the regulations are developed pretty close to that. But there are cases like tax increment financing, which is another tool, and that act was passed in 2007. They still don't have any regulations. So that's why it's never been used. So we hear about the Smart Track claiming they're using tax increment financing. They're not really using it under the legislative basis the way it's written. They're using some other kind of morphed kind of view of it. That tool was never properly designated or implemented.
Right.
Same thing was with inclusionary zoning. That legislation was passed by the Liberal government. Then they had some draft regulations. Municipalities didn't like the draft regulations.
Mm-hmm.
And then just before the election, they said, okay, municipalities, we're going to make the regulations wide open. You can do whatever you want. So that was more of a political way of trying to gain votes rather than trying to actually find the best way of implementing the inclusionary zoning legislation.
So this is not the last we've heard of Bill 108.
No, not by a long shot.
All right. Okay, so the first thing I wanted to address, Emily, is that Southern Ontario is home to the largest number of endangered species in Canada. How did that happen? Or am I sort of limited in my thinking that, you know, in my own neighborhood when I'm thinking about, you know, local wildlife, it's, you know, skunks and raccoons, and are they endangered, or is this a bigger problem than sort of beyond my suburban view?
Well, it's an excellent question and something that I think a lot of people in Ontario probably aren't aware of.
Mm.
That's the fact that, you know, we are really lucky in the sense that we have a lot of biodiversity in this region. And part of the reason is Southern Canada and Southern Ontario in particular is one of the warmest regions in Canada.
So
that's not only where a lot of people live, it's also where a lot of wildlife species live.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason that there's so many endangered species is primarily due to the fact that there are so many people who are cutting down trees, cutting down the habitat, and there's such a huge population of people here. So that's putting a lot of these species in trouble.
Right. It's the crunch of things because they're, you know, when you're driving from out from Toronto to anywhere in the surrounding area, you know, there isn't a lot of green anymore. There, you know, Toronto flows into Etobicoke and Scarborough and North York, which flow into, you know, Mississauga and Vaughan and Newmarket, and, you know, you barely know you're traveling through different cities anymore.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's home, I believe, to a quarter of our human population, and this region's population is only projected to grow significantly. So as our population grows, it's going to have a huge impact on nature and the health of wildlife. So that's one of the main reasons why this Carolinian zone, which is in southwestern Ontario, is home to one third of our country's at-risk plants and animals.
I confess, you know, maybe it's in my own biases or my own sort of gaps in the issue in terms of the knowledge, but, you know, I thought that, you know, protecting endangered species was sort of like the one environmental issue we could all agree on. Like, I understand that you're talking about the broader issues of climate change and climate change denial. I don't get that myself, but I understand how people sort of can tip that way. It's hard to see the broader effects in the everyday living. But, you know, I thought we all wanted to protect animals.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, our wildlife and our nature here in Canada and particularly in Ontario is something that we're really proud of.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that if more folks knew about the issue and knew that these protections for our species at risk were rolling back, I think people would and should be really, really upset about this.
Mm-hmm.
Because essentially what Ontario is doing is saying that for some species, if they occur in other areas, if they occur in the United States, for example, then we don't have to protect them here.
Right.
And to me, that is really upsetting. I don't want to be putting, you know, the fate of our wildlife and the fate of our nature into the hands of another jurisdiction. I think it's really, really up to us to protect our species that we have here and to protect nature here, because we we need nature, and it's such a big part of so many Ontarians' life.
Right, and I'm not a biologist, but it seems to me that, at least from my understanding from, you know, I guess nature documentaries, I've seen that, you know, you're talking about delicate ecosystems that it you know, yeah, there are certain types of fish or certain types of birds elsewhere, but the alchemy, the natural alchemy, so to speak, of a certain area depends on having those birds in that place, even if they also exist in another place too, that, you know, we have this delicate balancing act with nature. So it's not the same of, I guess maybe the government point of view is, well, who cares if store X doesn't stock my brand of toilet paper anymore? I can always go to store Y. And, you know, it seems like that way of thinking has sort of permeated how the government is approaching nature, which doesn't, yeah.
And that kind of thinking doesn't apply to nature and to biology.
Yeah.
You can't just get rid of habitat in Ontario because there's habitat elsewhere for it, especially in this time when we are in the midst of a global biodiversity crisis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that report from the UN, the IPBES report, just came out last month that showed that we're at risk of losing 1 million species around the world in the coming decades if we don't act now. So it was a cry to really ramp up our efforts to protect species. And so to see this kind of legislation that we have in Ontario that used to be a gold standard, it used to be a really solid piece of legislation, to see us move in the wrong direction and remove those protections is really upsetting.
The timing was especially bad.
Mm-hmm. It really is. And to go back to your point, too, about, you know, just because something is available in one area doesn't mean that we can't have it here.
Mm.
That's for species in particular, say like the wolverine.
Mm.
That's a species that has fairly wide range across Canada. But we need to protect the habitat for wolverine in Ontario because, you know, it's the linking habitat between Manitoba and Quebec.
Mm.
And wildlife need those corridors. They need to be able to move around, especially species like wolverine that have such a huge territory. So we can't just not protect that habitat here.
Right. Animals don't go through border checks.
Exactly.
Can you maybe just talk about some of the species that are going to be at risk, especially with these rules? I mean, is there any sort of plants or animals in particular that are in danger?
Yeah, the ones that I'm and WWF is the most concerned about in particular are the ones that are here in southern Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that are in this region that's very unique called the Carolinian Zone. And there's a lot of species here, some that you probably never even heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Say like the Jefferson salamander or the blue racer snake. We've got species like the flying squirrel or the American badger that are all really unique to this area.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually on the northern tip of their range. Like a lot of the species have a wider range down in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just the northern extent of where they live, in part because we have cold winters and a lot of them can't move further north right now. But, you know, we are in the midst of a changing climate. And a lot of these species ranges are actively moving north.
Right.
Ontario has a really, really important role to play in this time of climate change where habitats are shifting, species are moving in. So now it's really, really critical for us to be protecting that habitat.
Right. There's more dangers than just, you know, cutting down more forests to make more subdivisions. It sounds like a bombardment for some of these species.
Exactly. Yeah. And for species at risk in Canada, most of them are under threat from at least two major threats. So whether it be, you know, habitat loss and climate change or habitat loss and pollution, they're kind of getting it from all directions. So in particular right now, when we are in the midst of a climate crisis, it's really, really vital that we protect that habitat now and not just have this kind of static viewpoint that the Ontario government seems to be having right now.
Right. Do you know about any consultations that were done with, you know, your group or any sort of environmental groups that are concerned about endangered species? Because it seems like, you know, from Nature Ontario to you guys, it seems like no one was sort of talked to about what the practical impacts of the changes in Bill 108 might be.
Yes, we did have, we had a day of consultations with many of the environmental groups. And all of us voiced very, very strong opposition to the changes that were only proposed at that time. And we really were a united front. All of us felt that, you know, this was really, really important for us not to be making any kind of changes like the ones that they were proposing. But we weren't heard on any of those requests. And unfortunately, it seems like the needs and wants of development was really put first. And those were the ones that were listened to. And we even heard directly from the government that, you know, a lot of these changes are to make it easier, to make it more clear for developers to get permits and to be able to conduct business. But for me and for so many of us, you know, this is the Endangered Species Act. It should be really putting the needs of species first. You don't put the needs of business first when, you know, the name is Endangered Species Act. It's not the purpose of it.
Right. It could almost be argued that, you know, given the conditions and the dangers of climate change, that humans are an endangered species, and maybe we don't think about that either.
Yeah, it's really true. You know, we seem to think that we're disconnected somehow from nature, but we're not.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that this kind of thinking continues, where business and industry, you know, is allowed to go ahead, I think we're only putting ourselves in trouble at the end of the day.
Well, let me look at it this way. I mean, I imagine you guys deal with business people as well in terms of, you know, you're advocating for sustainability and for the environment. You know, are developers really that bloodthirsty, you know, so to speak, that, you know, that they're so eager to make a profit on, you know, some new development that they will pave over something like the Jefferson Salamander? I mean, this whole idea of pay to slay, it's, you know, just galling.
Yeah, and I you know, I think a lot of businesses want to be a part of the solution as well. They recognize that there is a problem here, and for them, there is a certain business risk as well if they're seen as the bad guys paving over endangered species habitat. So, you know, I certainly don't think that all businesses are in favor of this and want these changes to go through, because I think a lot of them recognize that there is a problem and they need to be a part of the solution as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've been thinking about how people might address this, and certainly, you know, there are a lot of municipal councils who were not in favor of the changes in Bill 108 and indeed actively passed resolutions to say they were opposed to 108. So one of the things I was thinking of, you know, suppose a city council were to just, you know, pretend that the protections in the Endangered Species Act were still there. You know, is that a plausible, I don't know, a plausible short-term solution that, you know, our councils can at least act in that regard? Or is that maybe going to be a pointless exercise, given that, you know, developers can, I guess, can just turn around and take it to the LPAT? And
yeah, that's an interesting point. I never thought of it from that perspective. You know, we're lucky that there are some councils who are opposed to this, and those are the ones that we're hoping are going to, you know, keep fighting against this, and you know, maybe there's a chance that we can still have this repealed, but.
Mm.
Right now, I think a lot of us are feeling just pretty upset that this bill was passed in the first place.
And, right.
Yeah.
So, what is WWF planning in terms of, you know, continued advocacy? Because, you know, as you said, you know, there are responsible developers who take great pride and care in sustainable builds and, you know, making sure that, you know, they don't look like environmental monsters. You know, can you still exert an influence there even without the sort of legal backing that, you know, something like the Endangered Species Act provides?
Yeah, that's something that, you know, WWF as a conservation organization, we're always optimistic and we're always willing to work with governments and try and get them to, you know, make compromises or, you know, find ways that, you know, species are still protected, but development perhaps can still occur in a responsible and sustainable way. So we'll keep pushing, we'll keep encouraging the government to work with us or to, you know, try and find some solutions here. But as I said, it is really just unfortunate at this point that they have put this bill through when so many of us were opposed to it.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned, you know, you're still feeling kind of the shell shock of this passing. And, you know, when I talk to people like you who are at the leading edge of trying to get action to save the environment, I always like to ask, are you hopeful? I mean, even this week, you know, after this bill is passed, are you hopeful that, you know, we can still save the world?
I am. I'm a, you know, I'm an eternal optimist. I think I wouldn't be working in this field if I wasn't. And I'm lucky in the fact that I work with really smart people who are constantly, you know, coming up with new solutions and new ideas on how we can help biodiversity in Canada and around the world. So I'm still hopeful. We still have a lot of people as individuals who really care about wildlife and who are feeling even more mobilized now to take action. So, you know, we'll try different routes now to try and get some impact on the ground. So, for example, I mentioned the Carolinian Zone. We have a whole bunch of our supporters who live in the Carolinian Zone who are part of a program called In the Zone, where they are actively trying to restore habitat for species at risk in their own backyards. So it's something that, you know, a lot of us probably don't think about, but if you actually plant, you know, milkweeds and all those like native plant species that are found here naturally, that helps species at risk in Ontario tremendously. So it's all those little things that we can do that do add up that help. It's too bad the government isn't taking action at a broader scale, but you know, in the absence of that, I think all of us can do at least something at home to help.
Tara, let me start by this memo that came to the information for the council report a couple of weeks ago that says Bill 108 could put a hole about $100 million in the capital budget over the next 10 years. That's a pretty big hole that just opened up quite suddenly for you.
I was just going to say, we don't know that we're not going to have that revenue, but what this bill does is it puts vulnerability on the DCs for recreation, trails, parks, parking, libraries, among some other services as well. And so because the future is really unknown in terms of the new revenue stream that's going to replace that, it's really meant to caution council that we're in a period now of a lot of uncertainty, and it's going to affect our ability to in terms of capital budgeting, at least in the short term, until we get more information on that new revenue stream and if it's going to be at least equal to what the DCs used to be, or is it going to be less? So we're uncertain.
Right. And I imagine the uncertainty for someone like you who specializes in the long-term planning, you know, that's probably the most, if I can put, you know, words in your mouth, that's probably the most frustrating part of this, is that, you know, you have to now compensate in ways that you don't have all the data for.
Correct. It's very frustrating. I that's a good word. And it's difficult to also provide and quantify the impacts of this. And I know that council and the community wants to know exactly, you know, in concrete information, like what does this mean? And because we don't have the regulations, All we can say is that we're concerned that our revenues are going to decline.
Mm-hmm.
And then if that's true, then we need to really make some decisions in terms of service levels or other streams of revenue that are going to replace that lost, you know, DC and Parkland dedication revenue.
Right. For the sake of clarity, these decisions are more going to be focused on the long term because council has a plan for like the capital plan for capital budget plan for this year, and then there's the 10-year plan. So stuff that is going to that was going to begin this year in terms of capital budgeting stuff, construction stuff, that is going to go on. And so what this does is going to effectively open up the next 9 years after that.
Yeah, yes, correct. So we've done some preliminary estimates and looking at what's already been approved. We don't see any significant concerns with what's already been approved and working within, you know, the parameters of the DC funding, because the DCs will not be going away immediately. So
right.
This is like the legislation is still going to be 1 to 2 years out in terms of effective date, likely.
Right.
And we don't know the date, but we feel that it's going to be about 1 to 2 years. So in the short term, there really shouldn't be too much impact. It's more, you're right. It's looking forward. It's the next 10-year horizon.
Right.
And looking at, you know, how these revenues and this change in revenue stream is going to affect our funding.
Do you know what kind of consultations were done with municipalities in terms of any feedback or anything that maybe the government didn't listen to or they didn't ask about this?
Sure. So there was quite significant consultation earlier in the year on the Housing Supply Action Plan.
Mm.
That was back in January of 2019. But at that time, and the city did respond, and I believe if you look on the info sheets, there was like our response was public, and it was Bill 66 at the time.
Right.
That plus the Housing Supply Action Plan. There were two big pieces of legislation back in January. And we were quite concerned at that time, based on, you know, the conversations happening, that they were going to remove or change our hard DCs. So a lot of the cities and a lot of the other municipalities were responding to the Housing Supply Action Plan at that time saying we need to continue to value growth pays for growth. And that's like a principle. You know, we need development charge revenue to put infrastructure into the ground for housing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't take away our hard DCs for roads, pipes, you know, water, wastewater, all of that stuff.
Right.
If you move, because there was a real concern at that time that they were going to move water, wastewater DCs and put those right into the user fee.
Right.
So we were really focused back in January on protecting and messaging how important the hard DCs were. And so then when this Housing Supply Action Plan got released in May 2nd, or the action plan, I guess we were happy to see that there was no impact for the most part in hard DCs.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we felt like the province did listen. However, they put on the table at that point this whole change in the community benefit charge regime,
right,
which would replace soft DCs and a number of other concerns, which we had no ability to comment on up until that point. That was a bit of a blindside for us. So then for the rest of May, we were really focused on pulling together our thoughts and working through all the implications of Bill 108 and the repercussions of what they were proposing. So at that point, we had not had an opportunity to comment in terms of that side of things at all.
From the sounds of it, you know, not to ascribe sinister motives to the provincial government, but, you know, maybe I am backhandedly. It sounds like they sort of painted you into making a choice, probably a false choice, but, you know, you're having to defend these hard DCs, the things that sort of make a neighborhood work, the streets, the sewage, the wastewater, the infrastructure, all that. And meanwhile, you kind of are stuck, so busy trying to defend those DCs that you can't get the other things that, you know, sort of enhance the neighborhood, things like community centers, things like libraries.
Yeah, so in our first, like when we were back in January, we really had thought that they were really focused on the hard DCs. And mm-hmm. so our messaging at that point, in terms of even like the sector, we have our Municipal Finance Association, and they were, and also the consultants that work on behalf of the municipalities for development charges. You know, for the city, we use Watson and Associates.
Mm-hmm.
So they were also really actively part of the conversation. And the province had struck a technical group, which those consultants and some of the industry also sat on, and they were really focused on ensuring growth was going to pay for growth. Like that principle was always at the forefront, and so that really captures hard and soft. But at the same time, there was a real concern about the hard DCs, and the elimination. So we were really focused on that, and the soft was not on our radar in terms of them changing the structure.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I feel like at this point now, they heard our message loud and clear, and they really have not touched the hard DCs. And in fact, they've actually moved solid waste, or like waste diversion and paramedic services, into the hard category.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually a benefit for the city. So, mm-hmm. So I'm actually, you know, I am very pleased about that. So there's a small benefit or a small win on that front. but at the other piece of it is just there's so much uncertainty now on the rest of the portfolio of soft DCs. And it's not just the soft DCs, it's also the heightened density bonusing revenue that we were actually planning on bringing forward in the short term. We actually had a workshop planned with council that if you follow the council agendas, you would have seen that canceled in May.
Right. Yeah.
Like it was right at the forefront of us starting that conversation. So that's been paused and
right.
may never start again because of this change. And then,
I forgot about
the
that.
Park land dedication.
Yeah. I forgot about that because council was looking at development charges and changing those. So that kind of throws that out with the bathwater too.
Well, the council approved the development charge bylaw in February.
That's right.
So
yeah.
that had already been finalized. They also approved the parkland dedication bylaw in January. So that had been finalized.
Mm-hmm.
And then in May, we were just going to start early conversations about heightened density bonusing. And so that heightened density bonusing workshop was canceled in May because of this legislation being tabled.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it's just, there's a lot of implications just in terms of what do those, like, so we're going to have to amend or basically repeal likely parts of those bylaws, either the parkland or the DC. We're
right.
still working through what those implications mean and then creating a whole new community benefit charge bylaw and plan.
Right.
So
not only are you undoing work that has been done, you have whole new work to undertake now.
Right. Yeah. And so one of the big messages for me in this has been the administrative burden that this is creating. In some ways you can say, is it more red tape? And it's more cost to change to a new regime.
Mm.
And that's been my big message is why was this necessary? Like we have a system that works and a system based on capital cost and that we generate revenues based on the cost of projects versus this whole new methodology that's really going to be land value driven.
Right.
And really puts even just in terms of that, just it's very uncertain in terms of financial planning and what's the value of the land across the city that's developable.
Right.
And how much revenue are we ever going to be able to generate out of that, and then trying to apply that revenue to capital projects. Like, it just, it's a whole change in the way we would look at a financial plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's also concerning, because what we had was very concrete in terms of recovering our costs.
Right.
And now we're going to a basis that's just, what kind of revenue could we generate, and then applying that to projects that, you know, and anyways, if I'm not
right,
sure captured that easily, but anyways, no. It's just much more uncertain.
Is there additional uncertainty, though, because, and I don't know money and real estate, so I'll ask you, basing it on land value, that goes up and down too, right? So doesn't that create more uncertainty?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And that was one of the key messages in my response too, back like in the consultation period. Absolutely. Market values are going to fluctuate. And how can you then plan properly based on a revenue that's going to fluctuate with market? It's doesn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and I'm disappointed with the direction that we've moved to, because I just don't think it supports, you know, really solid financial planning.
Right.
And it puts a lot of risk, I think, in terms of the tax base and what projects we can and can't do over the long term. It's not a stable revenue stream.
Mm-hmm. I realize it's not your department, but, you know, scuttlebutt gets around. Are you aware of any developers in Guelph who felt that, you know, RDCs are unfair or needed to, you know, be more competitive in that way? That, you know, maybe, you know, there's a lot of discussion about developers having influence on the provincial government to change certain rules. And so is it... something you've heard, that developers in Guelph are unpleased with how much they're being charged with DCs?
No, I haven't heard that directly. I mean, I think generally for the you know, for their industry, their position is absolutely they want to reduce the cost of development,
mm-hmm.
because they're a for-profit, you know, they're a for-profit company. An industry,
mm-hmm.
so they're absolutely their home builders association and the development associations are absolutely going to be advocating for lower development costs.
Right.
I just think that's just their natural position.
Right. No matter how reasonable, yeah.
Yeah. No matter how reasonable or no matter what the price, I think just you know their advocacy platform is. That their cost to build is too expensive.
Gotcha. I wanted to ask about one of the other differences that was mentioned in the memo, that with Bill 108, the payment schedule is going to be, you know, as it stands right now, it's when the city issues the building permit, but that the DCs are fixed. Now, under Bill 108, it's going to be when the zoning is approved. What's the impact there?
So that's an area where we're still looking in terms of the regs, in terms of specifically what the trigger point is going to be to fix that obligation.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know exactly if it's going to be zoning, if it's going to be planning application, like there's a number of things. Is it going to be like a minor variance is going to get that DC obligation fixed? Like, so we really want to be part of the conversation with the province on that point,
mm-hmm.
because our concern is that the longer that period is, our costs are escalating,
mm-hmm.
through that time period just from inflation and other things, and so
right.
you're leaving a gap. A fiscal, like a financial gap there.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be able to have, we need to be able to quantify it. So we would feel more comfortable if it was like up to a maximum of 2 years or
right.
up to a maximum of 1 year. Like, we don't want them to just leave it open-ended, because then again, we can't plan around that.
Mm-hmm.
So if they want to fix it earlier in the process, I understand that from the development community perspective, because they don't like when they get right up to the end of a process and then there's a, the fee structure changes so late in their process.
Right.
So I would just feel more comfortable if there was a maximum length of time where that obligation was going to be fixed. From an administration perspective, how are we going to be able to handle that? We're looking at that right now. Our permit systems and all of the development fees that we collect, and it's not just Guelph, it's across the province. The technology and the financial system is developed to bill at the point of building permit.
Right.
At some point earlier in the, and then it also doesn't allow any receivable collection, right? Because it's all due upon building permit. So now,
right.
like the legislation's also asking for six year payment plan on all non-res.
Right.
Like all industrial, commercial, and institutional DCs. And that's across like hard and soft, right?
Or right.
There won't be any soft left, but all the DCs that are left, that's a significant change.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also trying to now, work and look internally at our systems and how we would actually go about, setting up a receivable and invoicing that over the next 6 years on, developer that's probably going to sell that property to somebody. So now you're even
right.
you have like change of ownership conversations in there. Like, it's very complicated, and
yeah.
you know, you get into administrative burden. Like, this, it's a real concern. So we have technology problems and invoicing and administration kind of concerns all wrapped up into those two fairly, like on paper, minor changes, but
right.
in terms of how we would actually execute that internally, really challenging.
Right, because it's like when they change, you know, the sales tax, every cash register in every store automatically adds the sales tax. And so
right.
you have to write a new code or a new software to, you know, to change it from going from 14 to 13 or whatever. And,
right.
It's as you said, it's a minor thing, but it's such a major thing and probably probably not that easy to do given everything.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Right. And so we don't have the answers for that right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at what that means and likely working with our software vendor too, because it's not just going to be a Guelph problem, it's going to be a
right.
kind of a sector issue, and
right.
a lot of the sector uses the similar building permit software.
And, there's only 444 municipalities in Ontario too.
Right. Like, so this is really where it comes down to like the for me personally, the cost benefit analysis on this change. Like, I don't know if there's been enough recognition of the burden of cost on the tax and like on the municipal side in terms of, you know, implementing these changes. So, and who's going to pay for those costs.
Right.
And once again, that was David Amborski, Emily Giles, and Tara Baker. As Tara Baker explained, a report about the effects of Bill 108 will be brought to Guelph City Council for its June 24th meeting, and the agenda for that will be released this coming Thursday, or tomorrow if you're listening to it on Wednesday. Also tomorrow, or Thursday if you like, Councillor Kathy Downer will be our guest on Open Sources Guelph, and Councillor Downer is one of the leading advocates for the change from the old OMB rules to the new ones under the LPAT, and we'll ask Councillor Downer about her thoughts about going back. And that is it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, or you can download it from the host at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. You can also subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, and you will also get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Monday and an episode of End Credits on Friday. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson or at Guelph Politico. There is also Guelph Politico on Facebook, which you can find at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And thanks to everyone who has hopped on either through Patreon or through a monthly subscription at PayPal. That is greatly appreciated, and it is great to have so many new people supporting this podcast and supporting Guelph Politico. So thank you. And speaking of which, for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.